Welcome to TAPS, the Accounting Podcast Series. I'm Albie Brooks and working with me is Abu Treloar. Today our guest is Anne Lillis. Having joined the Department of Accounting here at Melbourne in 1997, Anne has held the prestigious Fitzgerald Chair in Accounting. Anne is one of the leading management accounting researchers globally, evident in her numerous publications in high-quality international journals, and her receipt of the Dean's Prize for Exceptional Distinction in Research and Research Training in 2011. Anne's portfolio of work extends to her role as head of department, an outstanding teaching career, and contributions of service to the university, the academy, and the profession. Anne is currently Professor Emerita here at Melbourne. Welcome to TAPS, Anne.
Thanks, Albie.
So much to talk to you about across such a distinguished career. But first, having recently stepped away from your role, how do you feel about stepping back after such a long and distinguished career?
Well, first, thank you so much, Albie, for those very, very kind words, very generous reflections on my career. I guess stepping away, I have quite mixed feelings, and I think it would be a bit odd if I didn't really. I've certainly loved everything I've done as an academic. I've had a thoroughly enjoyable career. But it's been a long career. I started work when I was 18 because my parents didn't want to support me to go to university and in fact didn't want me to go to university at all. So I studied part-time for 23 years by the time I finished my PhD and worked full-time from the time I was 18. So turning 65 this year, it seems like a long time of trying to juggle a lot of balls in the air. I had two children along the way and kept working through most of that time as well. So I feel like it's time to perhaps do some other things while I still feel young and fit enough to do so. There's plenty to do and just being able to take my time a bit more and not feel overcommitted so much of the time. But, you know, I can't deny that I have a little bit of FOMO. As you've got to watch the year get started, it's kind of hard to kind of hold yourself back and not feel like you're on the starting box with everybody else. So a bit of mixed feelings, but I think it's probably the right decision at this time. And in the emerita position, I can still continue to do a lot of the things that I really enjoy doing and, you know, still remain engaged with the department. I wouldn't have wanted to cut myself off completely. So I'm quite pleased to take on this role now, which enables me to do the things that I really like doing.
I think it's one of the great things about the profession is that it is possible to sort of step back in, even though it looks like one is stepping back fully, but to step back a little more slowly than maybe can happen in some other professions. So I think that's a great thing about ours and other professions as well.
Absolutely.
Perhaps we could explore some of the key developments in your area of expertise in regards to performance management. In short, what are some of the things we know now that we didn't know, say, 20 years ago, and where do we still need to go?
Okay, well, it's kind of a very timely question. Interestingly, a publisher reached out to me in the last couple of months asking me to edit a handbook on performance measurement and performance management. And I sort of thought carefully about this and I thought, well, it was a real opportunity to kind of work on something that would draw a kind of put a cap on a career that's been devoted to this area of research. So I've invited Jennifer Grafton to come on board and edit this volume with me, and we've started putting a kind of a program together for that. So we're hoping to really draw together a lot of the kind of key the scholars that have really worked in this area to really get a handle on what we know and what we don't know in the area of performance measurement and where we should go in the future. So I don't really have a full answer to the question, but it's something that I'm really looking at exploring and trying to kind of pull together in the next little while. But I guess just off the top of my head, I think a few key things that we really do know more about is the limitations of measuring and managing performance just using accounting numbers. I think we've kind of got that pretty well sorted, that it's not a good thing to do, and we've kind of moved away from that. I think we also understand a lot more about the importance of strategy in guiding what we measure and how we measure it and why we measure it, things for performance measurement. And I think it's also that we know a lot more about using performance measurement to guide future actions rather than to focusing on the past, on reviewing the past. I think we've moved along that direction as well. Where do we need to go? Well, my view is that we really need to stop focusing on getting better performance measures. I think, you know, we can turn ourselves inside out trying to add performance measures to capture different parts of tasks. We can design better performance measures, whether they're longer term or more complete or whatever they might be, have all these better attributes. But we still find, no matter what we do in performance measurement, we still find that the measures come up short. So, yeah, the kind of issues that I've raised before when I've given lectures on this area, you know, we have police breath testing themselves on the roadside in order to meet their performance targets. We have, you know, hospitals managing waiting lists in order to meet their kind of, you know, bed targets and so forth. We have trains skipping stations and trams running short to meet their performance targets. Now, I often use the trams as a really good example because I think it's the perfect example of how better measures just don't help. Right. If you think about it, schedule adherence is a really good performance measure for a transport provider. People care about trams running on time and trains running on time. But what you don't foresee is that the ways in which they might be able to do that, which is by skipping stations or by running short and turning around in order to meet their schedule. So these are well-intentioned performance measures and yet they still fail. So my thought is we need to stop looking at just trying to get better performance measures, and we need to get a kind of a better understanding of, you know, how you manage performance overall beyond just the way we measure it. You know, what are the other, how does the performance measurement kind of interact with the other organisational practices to make sure that we actually achieve what we want to out of the performance measurement process? So it's really a matter of understanding much more broadly the things that happen in organisations, like monitoring, training and development, organisational culture, organisational values, all those sorts of things that are kind of part of the context of performance measurement, and understand much more about the interaction between those things. And as I say, I think it's just misguided to focus on improving measurement just in and of itself.
I think that's a really good point about certainly the performance metrics, because we can turn ourselves inside out trying to recalibrate a metric to make it better or more informed, which is a worthy thing in itself. But as you say, doing that in isolation is not necessarily going to benefit the organisation overall.
What do we do in the trams case? Do we just add another measure saying, oh, well, not just schedule adherence, but also keeping all of your passengers on board till you get to the end of the line? You can't just keep supplementing the measures to overcome the behavioural issues, I think is the big problem here.
Yeah, really good point. So as an example of some of your recent work, you have a co-authored paper upcoming for publication, which I'd like to explore a little with you. Would you like to... How did this particular piece of work come about in the first place?
Okay, well, it partly follows on from the prior discussion. So this particular paper is about subjectivity in performance measurement. And I guess I'd always thought that subjectivity, I've always had this kind of issue with objective quantitative performance measures, that they lead to so many of the problems that we see. And yet, if you look at the notion of subjectivity, it has a bit of a bad rap. And you know, there seems to be this general presumption that people prefer objective performance measures over subjectivity, you know, because of all the risks of bias and favoritism and all the kind of things that subjectivity is kind of a pejorative term. But I thought, I think we really don't fully understand the utility of subjectivity in the performance measurement process. And so what we set out to do was kind of try to get a better handle on the way firms use subjective performance measurement. What are firms actually doing? How are they avoiding some of these behavioural consequences? Because not all firms suffer from these issues. So we wanted to try and explore in practice how firms are overcoming, you know, some of the behavioural issues that are readily documented elsewhere. So this seemed like an ideal opportunity for a field study. You know, I'm a field study researcher. I like to dig deep on an issue and find out, you know, what's actually happening in practice. So I had worked with both Julia Mundy and Mary Molina on other field study projects. They both, you know, do interview-based work, and working with them was going to enable us to do a much broader study. So I brought them on board with it. They were both very keen and enabled us to do something much broader. I would have only had the capacity to probably study one or two firms here. Instead, we managed to do four firms across three countries, three continents. And we developed the whole project together. So that's kind of how it got started. It really came from a genuine interest in trying to look more deeply at this question of how firms manage the performance measurement dilemma and avoid the behavioural consequences that go with these kind of quantitative performance measures.
Yep. As you alluded to, it looked to me like a really good example of what I'd call a global study.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what the three of you did.
Okay, so we were able to get access to two firms in the UK, one in the US and one in Australia. And so we each drew on contacts that we had to kind of set those up. It enabled us to do 42 interviews overall across the three continents, talking to both subordinate and supervising managers. And these were four large global firms. They were very large firms. So both levels of management that we spoke to, both subordinates and supervisors, were both managers. Like I said, the subordinates had subordinates as well. But we really focused on the way that what we wanted to do was capture a task level, a management task level, where the task itself is complicated. And that's where quantitative performance measurement fails, because you can't design enough hard objective performance measures to completely encompass the task that the manager has. And so if you choose a small set of measures, you direct behavior in that way and you don't get the manager's commitment to the full task range. So we wanted to target that level of management where that complexity existed. We captured, as I say, 42 managers across four firms, and we got really great engagement with the firms once we were in there. I think they found the questions interesting. They found the discussions interesting. And it gave us a great opportunity to reflect on their performance measurement practices. And then we ended up with a massive amount of transcripts from these 42 interviews, which we transcribed and we coded using Invivo to try and distill the kind of important themes that related to our research question.
So out of all of that, what did you find?
What did we find? Well, what we found, first of all, that really surprised us was a really high level of subjectivity in the performance measurement practices of these firms. And so, the other interesting thing was that they started by telling us in a couple of cases, oh no, it's very quantitative, it's very objective, there is no subjectivity in it. And so, like, if, for example, in the firm that I was in, they said this is the bonus formula, there's these three terms in the formula, each one has a multiplier attached, that's for the business performance, for the firm performance, for the business unit performance, and for the individual performance. Each one of those three things has a multiplier attached, and we pop in the numbers and out pops the bonus, all very formulaic. So at one level I'm thinking, okay, I might need to find another firm because we're here studying subjectivity. But digging into it, we found that there were layers upon layers of subjectivity in every one of the terms that went into that formula from which popped the bonus. So it actually ended up being a really interesting exploration of really intensive subjectivity. There was subjectivity throughout the process. Every one of these ratings for individuals, ratings at the business unit level, they were all based on subjective assessments of performance. And then overlaying that, there was a calibration process, which was in effect another layer of subjectivity where additional managers would kind of comment on individual performance. So it was very, very subjective. So the really important theme that came through is that what these firms were doing was assessing not just what people achieved, which was the kind of quantitative outcomes that usually targets that were set at the start of the year, but also how they achieved them. And so they talked about the what and the how, and they subjectively assessed the behaviours that people adopted to achieve their targets. And they said things like, you know, you won't get an outstanding or exceeds expectations, no matter whether you have knocked the performance criteria out of the park, if you've done it in a way that's not consistent with our firm values, if you've kind of, you know, you've done it at the expense of your colleagues, you know, you've actually kind of, you know, not facilitated their work, but actually made their life more difficult in order to achieve your own targets, you'll get a below expectations. So they actually actively assessed the behaviours of individuals to achieve their targets. But what that meant, of course, was the kind of behavioural things that they assessed were things like collaboration, adhering to firm values and things like that. But that introduced a lot of subjectivity. So what we also found was that they had a lot of practices in place which tried to kind of assure the quality of the subjective information they were using. So they did they collected a lot of data. They tried to use an evidence-based approach where they collected data from the peers and the supervisors that each individual had dealt with. And then through the calibration process, they had a fair amount of transparency around how that calibration process worked. They collected more data, put more data on the table, invested huge resources in basically arriving at these subjective judgments in a way that the subordinates that we spoke to also felt that these were quite valid and that they were well supported by evidence. So there wasn't a lot of debate about, you know, the quality of this subjectivity or the potential for bias and things like that. So, you know, it was really interesting in terms of certainly not what we expected to find.
So on face value, what looks like an objective set of criteria, the subjectivity, what is actually built into the determination of what is this objective formula, for want of a better word, rather than the determination of the objective criteria with then an add-on that sort of adjusts for the subjective evaluation. Is that?
That's right. Interestingly, we used to ask people the question, could you tell us how much of your bonus is determined subjectively and how much is objective? And they weren't able to answer that question. So this is one of the things that I think is interesting about this is that in the literature more broadly, I think people have often taken the results of what appears to be objective performance measurement with bonus schemes and so on, and thinking that those criteria are purely quantitative as they're expressed in the bonus formula, but actually determining the numbers that go into there could be underpinned by huge degrees of subjectivity which they're missing. So, you know, I think it's, I don't think you would know, the participants in the study themselves did not immediately see the subjectivity that was in there.
So do you think, this is off the cuff, but do you think that the designers of the reward system or the bonus system, that was hence deliberate?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The impression we got was that they simply didn't trust the quantitative metrics on their own to deliver what they should. So they wanted to know not just, you know, whether people met their sales targets or their cost reduction targets or all these other quantitative. They thought, no, that's not enough to just know that they achieved those targets. We want to know how they did it. And a few people said that, you know, particularly the Australian firm I was looking at, a few people who had been working in other firms as well said they felt it was one of the best performance measurement systems they had worked with.
Okay.
supervisors and subordinates because of its comprehensiveness in kind of trying to track and capture those behaviours and understand them. What it meant was that people at the end of the day felt that the good people win in the end, you know, that the people who had the organisational values at heart, who collaborated with others, who facilitated the work of the organisation in flexible ways, they were the ones who won in the end because they were actually recognised for that. Mm. Whereas the people who just beat the sales target out of the park didn't get there in the end. That was good, yeah.
We've touched on this, but so to extend this out then to sort of more broadly, what do you think of the implications of this? Because this is a significant piece of work. So, you know, what are the implications, do you think, going forward?
I think it's the notion that subjectivity can be really positive. But to do so, it has to be underpinned by an organisational infrastructure that really supports its use in ways that are kind of, we're actually working on a second piece of work now, trying to kind of get to the bottom of why it seemed to work so well. And the way we're kind of understanding that is that there was a lot of transparency within the system, and people kind of understood what was going to be subjectively assessed, and they understood how you would do well on those subjective assessments, and you know that they understood that there would be information collected from peers and so forth. So what we think is that it's two things. We think it's clarity and we think it's credibility of the system and the supervisory application of subjectivity. So those are the two principles that underpin what we call a relational contract. So what we think is happening in these firms is that they're actually building very strong relational contracts with their employees, which govern the performance measurement process and move away from the explicit contract, the words that are written in a document when people are hired about, you know, how much they earn and what bonus they can achieve and so forth. Mm-hmm. There is then underpinning on a 6 month by 6 month time period, this relational contract that underpins how you'll actually be assessed within that framework of the explicit mm-hmm. contract and how you'll be rewarded.
Mm. Well, I look forward to seeing that second piece of work, follow-up piece of work as well. This is sort of really interesting. And I think you must be buoyed, given that you have stepped back, but to be involved in this sort of piece of work towards that time when you did do that, that this is, to me, it seems such a significant piece of work. Yeah.
Well, it feels like a really, really big piece of work. And it has been. I mean, it was something that became sort of all-consuming, but to ultimately have it accepted at the Accounting Review was a huge relief. I mean, but it's taken 7 years to get it there. It's been a huge ordeal, and I think that had it got knocked back in the last round at the Accounting Review, I don't think we had a rewrite in us. I think we had reworked and reworked this paper within an inch of its life. It's ended up being a much better paper than what it was when we first submitted it. There's no question about that. Mm. But it was hard work to get this kind of work across the line US journal. So while I'm very relieved to finish off having put that paper to rest because it was such a huge piece of work. And it didn't in many ways draw together a lot of the themes that have kind of governed my interests and my research over many years. So it's a really nice way to cap things off, yes.
Yeah, well done. Well done. Just changing tack for a bit. So if we switch to the education side for a moment. So any thoughts on where we need to move in the education of future accountants?
I think I can probably speak best about management accounting, rather than accounting more broadly. I'm not sure what we should be doing to train auditors of the future or standard setters of the future. That's kind of really not my ball of wax, but I can probably comment best on management accounting. I think overall, I think we've done a reasonable job of of embedding management accounting within organisations the way we teach it. And you know, you and I have certainly kind of had years of experience doing that in terms of teaching with case studies and so forth. I think we capture a lot of the complexity and ambiguity that exists in organisations, and we try to position management accounting as being part of a much bigger kind of story and a much bigger infrastructure that exists within organisations. But I think we can do more. You know, I think, you know, it's kind of, after being in the field a lot, it's kind of made me raise the question, why do we teach things like performance measurement without really teaching anything about or without involving or engaging with human resources practices, you know, sort of along the way? You know, it doesn't exist. You know, performance measurement doesn't exist in isolation. It is part of a much bigger endeavor, which is cross-disciplinary within organizations. You know, why do we teach budgeting without any reference to, you know, operations management or financial management that kind of underpins a lot of the budgeting practices? So I think, you know, I would really like to see management accounting, you know, if only, and I know I think you and I have had these discussions before, but if only you could reduce the silos within universities so that, you know, within the faculty we had more cross-disciplinary engagement. You know, I don't think people in management even know that we teach performance measurement. You know, I don't think we know what they teach. And I think there would be so much synergy that could be brought in there. And I think it would do our students a great service if we could, you know, pull some of that together. But I think the other big thing, that's, you know, kind of, I guess, you know, my where I always wanted to go with management accounting education. I think the other big thing across the board, though, is in terms of accounting, is just being really good at data analysis. I think, you know, I think as students really need we really need to build their strength and confidence in the analysis of kind of broad ranging data to answer business problems. And I don't think it's just a new thing that goes with the idea of big data. I think it's something that's always been there. And I know way back in my days at Victoria College, back in the mid 80s, I was trying to convince students that, you know, organisations were kind of like a big data bank, and that managers have, you know, really important questions about how things are going, you know, and these things can be flexibly defined. Like, so for, it might be a product, it might be a business unit, it might be a capital project, it might be, you know, an idea, it might be a strategic idea that they need kind of analysis for. And all the data is there somewhere, and people need to be able to access and analyse it flexibly. And in some ways that hasn't changed, but the access to the data is much easier now. And, you know, we have many more tools. So, and I think managers in practice have always wanted people who could do this kind of stuff, who could analyse that data flexibly. So hopefully we'll get better at doing that.
Yeah, no, excellent points. So one last one from me. So as you step back a little, what would be your advice to someone starting out in an academic career with a particular interest in management accounting?
No.
Yeah, I was going to say, would you try to talk them out of it? That would be, I know many people who would say, I'd talk them out of it.
There's probably easier ways to earn a living, but, you know, I think we've had, I certainly think I've come through in an era where it you know, wasn't as difficult as it is for a lot of people coming through now. Although I think management accounting has gone through a pretty flat patch, particularly in terms of research and publishing in the US. But I think it's coming out of that. I think that's been, you know, recognised, acknowledged, and I think there's been a bit of a recovery and a resurgence. So I think that's a good thing. I think there is a future for management accounting, and I think there's some recognition that it may in fact be more important than some other areas of accounting, you know, overall. And I think people would struggle if they didn't have that, you know, some knowledge of the way managers use information within organisations, you know, no matter which part of accounting they're working in. But I guess my advice would be spend time in firms. You know, whether someone's going to be a field researcher or not, you've got to spend time in firms talking to managers about the things that matter to them, and about what they do and how they do it. Because I think management accounting textbooks generally are very poor quality in terms of capturing, you know, the sort of the reality of the business world. So I think, you know, people who are doing, and I don't think we a lot of our research is driven by archival data. So again, there's not much of our research that's evident in the top journals that comes from firms either. So I think people need to spend time in firms talking to practicing managers. I think also, you know, making sure that they invest really deeply in study design upfront. So making sure that the study design is really well thought through to deliver the outcomes that you want. Because you get one shot at most studies. And so whether you're in the field or whether you're pulling together data from an archive, you know, from a firm-based archive, if you miss out on that first round, it's pretty hard to kind of like patch it up. So I think, you know, really investing in the study design upfront is absolutely critical. I think it's much more critical in management accounting than it is in financial accounting, because when you're using public databases, you can go back and redo, you can go back and add more variables in, you can go back and, you know, revisit things. It's very hard to do that in a management accounting setting. I would also say, but not seeing management accounting as really distinct and separate from financial accounting, but starting to look more, or, you know, being much more engaged at the kind of interface between the two. I think there's a lot of opportunities there that they will, and that'll become a really important research area of the future, I think. We need to know more about the compromises that are made. You know, financial accountants depend a lot on data that's collected, you know, within organisations that's driven by management accountants. And so a lot of that data ends up in financial reports. And by the same token, management accountants are also to some extent dependent on, you know, what's required for financial reporting purposes in terms of what guides what they do within organisations. And I think we need more understanding of that, the compromises that are made at that interface between the two, in terms of, you know, where they end up. And finally, I think just being very adept at quantitative research. You know, keeping up with training, being right on top of the training, and but still retaining that contact with the field. So I think I haven't advised any PhD student in management accounting more recently to go to specialise in field research. I think it's a pretty big ask, and it's a dangerous path for a young researcher. So I think it's really important to be really, really capable in the area of in quantitative research methods, but to keep that, you know, one foot in the field to make sure that you're dealing with stuff that actually matters and is interesting. I think, you know, there are some really good models out there, I think, for people who've done that really well. And I think, you know, we have some of them come to the University of Melbourne and speak occasionally. And I think, you know, they've been great for that.
All right. Well, this has been a pleasure, an absolute pleasure.
Thanks,
We really appreciate you joining us here at TAPS, Anne, and we wish you well going forward. And obviously you will continue to contribute to the Academy and the developments of management accounting over the next few years. But for the moment, thanks for joining us here at TAPS.
Thanks so much, Albie, and thanks very much for inviting me to do this. It was it's a real privilege to be invited to do this and to have the opportunity to reflect on things a bit. I really appreciated the opportunity to do that. So thank you again, and I wish everybody all the best as well.
Thanks, Anne.
Okay, thanks, Albie.